from the Moen Broadcast Center. This is Air Talk. I'm Austin Cross, filling in today for Larry Mantle as he takes a much, much deserved break this week. Happy Wednesday to you. Can you believe it? Day after tomorrow, 2021. If you can hear my voice, looks like we made it. Want to play that song right now. We're almost there, so stick with us. Hey, just so you know, Governor Newsom is giving an update right now on the pandemic in California. We're going to keep our eyes on that for news that you can use. You'll definitely want to stick around for that. Hey, you know, I think it's safe to say that the year 2020, wait for it, has been like no other. How many times have you heard that one this year? It has been like no other, though. And later on this hour, we're going to look at how the defining moments of this year, or this pretty defining year in general, could also define a generation of young people. And just think about how the Great Depression has helped shape people of that era, for example, or the impact of the 2008 recession on millions of millennials. As a member of the millennial generation, I don't know, we've had a pretty rough go so far if I think about it too much. But anyway, first, we're going to get our daily look at COVID-19 with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist at Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. And as usual, if you have medical questions related to COVID-19, we're taking your calls at 866-893-5722. Now is the time if you've had a burning question that you have been wondering about. We're here to get you those answers that you need so we can help keep everybody informed right here. 866-893-5722. You can also tweet at AirTalk or leave a comment on our Facebook page. Dr. Schreiner, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Austin.
Well, doctor, we learned that the super contagious variant of the virus, the one that was first discovered in the UK, was detected in Colorado. And from what I read here, infected a patient, a man in his 20s, no recent travel history. What do you know about this?
Well, this one's been given the peculiar name of variant B1.1.17.
It's easy to remember.
Peculiar name, but it's you know, this is a normal behavior for coronaviruses to develop mutations. And I think none of us are surprised that we found it here in the United States. It may not be quite as common as it is in England right now, but it's not a surprise, and it's not a surprise that this happens. Coronaviruses, like influenza, undergo mutations. The vast majority of the time, those mutations are actually not helpful for the virus, but this one may have developed a mutation that makes it more infectious. I reviewed the paper actually this morning. It's a preprint paper. It's not been published yet in peer-reviewed journals, but the data suggests that this is based on a modeling study, and the fact that this particular variety of coronavirus is so common now in parts of England speaks to the fact that it's been sort of able to outrun the previous variety. The good news is it doesn't appear to be nastier. It's not likely to make you more sick, nor also it appears to be susceptible to the vaccines that we're now trying to rapidly deploy.
You know, there's been so many things about this virus that have either surprised us or we've actually been a little bit lucky about, I would actually say, because this one, it's more likely that you could get infected by it, but it's not, you know, more likely to cause the serious harm. But I want to ask you about how worried we should be about this, but I'm also worried about other mutations. I mean, is it possible that it could mutate to actually become, say, more deadly?
It's possible. You know, these viruses, their behavior is to try to, you know, find the fittest form of themselves. And, you know, that's why there's some urgency to try to get the population vaccinated. And I think this is a lesson to pay attention to as we move forward, because this isn't going to be the last pandemic we deal with. And we know that viruses that are a result of what we call a spillover event from animals to humans often are some of the most challenging in terms of diagnosis, treatment, and vaccination. So I think that we need to be very realistic that this could happen. Generally, as viruses move through replication in the population, they may find advantages in their infectivity, but they often become a little bit less nasty. That is a generalization, and remember, this is a brand new virus, so we don't know for sure. But there are lots of laboratories that are keeping an eye on that, and I think that We're going to have little bouts of epidemics for the next several years. What we need to do is just get the big pandemic under control and get people vaccinated.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner is with us. She's infectious disease specialist at Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. And if you have any questions related to COVID-19, we would love to hear them from you. Please give us a call. 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can also tweet us at AirTalk or leave a comment on the Facebook page. Dr. Brian from Mount Washington has a question. He says this. He says, I recently tested positive and my family did as well. Our thoughts are with you, Brian. And his question here is, could we be around one another or do we have to isolate in different rooms?
Well, that's a good question. There's no doubt that your virus is your virus. So I think in an abundance of caution, I would recommend keeping your interactions to a minimum. That being said, because you're all positive in the same household, it's better to stay put and not mix with other households, and you don't necessarily have to isolate by yourself. But we do recommend that you really don't mingle too much, even if you're all infected, because there are some differences in each person's virus. And we don't really know what happens if you're continuing to encounter fresh virus. So in an abundance of caution, as much as you can isolate, it's probably a good idea at least for the first 7 to 10 days. And then hopefully everybody will get over it and you'll move on. I would also like to say that people who have had COVID, of which unfortunately we have lots and lots of people now, that we do recommend you still get vaccinated 90 days after you've recovered from your acute infection, because the vaccine is probably likely to provide more immunity than natural infection.
We're talking with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist at Huntington Hospital. And doctor, I'm really curious right now about you and your colleagues, because I know that yesterday we set another single day record for COVID-19 deaths. And a lot of hospitals are finding it increasingly difficult to manage care. And I know that Huntington Hospital also has released their plan for rationing care. That's a word that we didn't want to see at this point. Rationing care when supplies become limited. Could you speak about the thought process behind that plan and also maybe update us on how the hospital is faring during this surge?
It's the most challenging time I think we've ever faced as a hospital in terms of trying to manage this pandemic and also provide the kind of care we need to for our non-COVID patients. And it's just really a really big effort to try to get this under control and keep it under control. All hospitals have scarce resource policies. That's a normal thing for a hospital to have. You know, usually those are set up for some sort of catastrophic one-time event like a bioterrorist attack or a plane crash or something. Pandemics are harder because they're ongoing and they don't stop just the next day after the event has happened. So that makes it more challenging. We really strongly believe in being very transparent and honest with the community that we serve, and that's why the administration decided to release the letter to explain what a scarce resource policy is. And basically what it is, it's a committee that's formed by a bioethicist, a clinician, a nurse, a community member, and sometimes an administrator or a fourth person. It's not anybody who's actually taking care of any of the patients. And they examine if we get to a point where we have a very big shortage of, let's say, oxygen tubing or oxygen tanks or ventilators or whatever. They examine patients from on a clinical basis in terms of whether or not a person would benefit from that intervention. They don't know the patient's ethnicity. They don't know anything about their insurance status or anything. The only thing they know is their clinical history and their age. And we hope to goodness that we don't have to do this. Healthcare worker ever wants to have to be put in the position to make this decision. Our job is to save lives and provide the very best care for everybody we can. But sometimes there's just a limit to how much resources we have. The other piece of this is that it's not a black and white sort of thing. We can kind of dial up and dial down. Perhaps we use a little less oxygen than we maybe would in a normal situation, just to sort of try to share and make sure that we're very fair about how we do this. But it is a very important part of hospitals to maintain their ability to take care of at least the majority of the community. And I just want to reassure the public that the hospital is deeply, deeply committed to providing the very, very best cutting-edge care for all of our patients, and we have not yet had to institute this policy, and hopefully we won't.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner is with us. Doctor, we have such a limited amount of time, but I do want to get in just one more question from Vinny in Monrovia, because I think that it's actually a very important question for a lot of people right now. So in about 30 to 20 seconds, is it safe for a person with an autoimmune disease to receive the vaccine?
Yes, it is. There have been a few cases of allergic reactions, but we are concerned about patients who are immunosuppressed with autoimmune diseases, who take medications that may suppress their immune system. That's a higher risk population. They should get the vaccine. They certainly need to discuss it with their physician and the person who's going to vaccinate them. They should watch things very carefully, but I would very much recommend it for anybody who's immunocompromised.
Thank you so much, Dr. Schreiner, for joining me today. That's Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist at Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. Coming up next, we're talking about how the pandemic will affect younger generations. It should be an interesting conversation. Air Talk will be back with you in just a few minutes here on KPCC. Jams. Parker on the mixing board. Thank you for that. I'm Austin Cross filling in for Larry Mantle this week on Air Talk, and it is so good to have you with us. I'm dancing a little bit in the studio. It's okay if you do too. Hey, next hour, we're going to be talking with mixologists about their favorite cocktails ahead of the holiday season, and we'll want to hear from you about what you're planning to make this New Year's. You know, I like to think about how the chapter that we're currently living is going to be written about in somebody's doctoral thesis in like 200 years, right? I'm a big history person. You might figure that one out at some point. And it really makes me think of the gin craze in England in the early 1700s. You can look that one up. It was this chapter when people were just really wild about gin. And so here I am thinking, you know, I'm sure a lot of people's alcohol tolerance is up this year. So maybe drinks of this generation will seem stronger to future generations. That's what I'm thinking about right now. I don't know what you think about that one, but that's actually a perfect segue to our next conversation because we're looking at the long-lasting impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic and how it's going to affect the generations coming out of this time. Now, you know, there is no doubt that 2020 has been a year for the history books, if we have books in the future, you know. Between COVID-19, George Floyd protests against racism and police brutality, the presidential election, which still seems like it's going on for some reason, it's been a time filled with pain, fear, and of course, a lot of uncertainty. And like many crises in American history, the events of this year will help define a generation, maybe a few of them. Now, in the 20th century, we had the greatest generation, right? And that was shaped by the Great Depression and World War II. And millennials, of course, we came of age with the events of 9/11 and the recession. It left a lot of impact on us. Well, generations of people are shaped by events that are not only economic, but social and emotional. And I think it's safe to say that the pandemic has ticked just about 1, 2, 3, you know, all of those boxes. But how will it shape our futures? Well, I'd love to hear from you. How do you think the pandemic will affect your future? If you have children, what do you anticipate that this event will mean for their lives? What qualities of this period do you expect will come to define a generation? I want to hear from you. The number is 866-893-5722. I'm really looking forward to what we hear back from people on this one. Please, 866-893-5722. Or you can comment on the AirTalk page, or you can tweet us at AirTalk. I want to welcome my first guest. That's Marina Gorbis, Executive Director of the Institute for the Future. And that's a nonprofit research and consulting organization based in Silicon Valley. Marina, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, great to be with you.
So I understand that the Institute for the Future, which is a very cool name, by the way, is modeling different post-pandemic scenarios. And so I'm really curious. Can you tell me a bit about what kinds of research you do to develop these scenarios?
Sure. We're using something called the alternative scenario methodology, which is basically based on the idea that, you know, the future is not something that is a given. There are a lot of things that we can do to shape the future in different directions. So it's looking at a whole range of different possibilities, from basically continuing on the same path as we were before to radically changing our ideology and set of policies to move in a very different direction. The way we go about doing this scenario work is, first of all, we start with history, because it's essential when you think about the future to really understand historical patterns. How did we get to where we are? This is not the first time this humanity went through pandemics. We've lived through many of them, and there are certain patterns that they follow. So you start with understanding the future and these large patterns. But of course, you know, as you think about the future, there are these patterns, but they don't necessarily repeat themselves exactly in the same way as they were before. So as one of my colleagues said, there are no facts about the future. You know, we have a lot of data and a lot of facts about the past, but there are no certainties about the future. So what we do a lot of is we look at signals. There's this famous phrase by science fiction writer William Gibson that the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed, meaning that there are signs and signals of the future all around us. And if you're trained to look at those signals and pick them up and say, why is this happening? What is this a signal of? What's the larger transformation? You start thinking about, well, what does it mean in the future? Where can it go? So it's a collection of a lot of different ways and of picking up signals, understanding history, talking to experts from different disciplines, talking to people on the ground in terms of what is their experience of this event? How are they dealing with that? And on that basis, you kind of have this framework to develop a whole set of different scenarios.
Wow, I imagine things can be really different, just given so many different factors in society. I know there are a number of plagues over human history that are well documented, and different things came out of those. Just like there were different world wars, of course, and things were different after each one of those world wars. So given your research, what scenarios appear to be the most likely to play out in the United States post-pandemic?
Well, there's multiple scenarios possible. One of them is basically continuing to the way we were before, which is that post-pandemic, as people get more and more people get vaccinated, we learn how to deal with this, with the virus better, things will start opening up and we'll continue on the path of growth. But the kind of growth we'll have is, again, very unequally distributed. And that's continuing from the past, that we're going to see tremendous wealth inequalities. Past the pandemic, we'll have a lot of people with high levels of debt. Returns of this economic sort of prosperity or boom that's post-pandemic will go to people who own capital equity or they have, you know, financial assets, and that will continue. But people who are wage earners and regular people will be highly disadvantaged economically. So that's not a particularly great scenario. The alternative scenario, which we call a transformation scenario, is that we really take lessons from this pandemic. And this pandemic is kind of a big event, but it's revealed a lot of things that have been happening for decades. Mm. You know, what we're experiencing today is a result of kind of choices and decisions that were made decades ago around how, you know, our tax structure, our kind of what we decide to invest in, what kind of infrastructure we build, what's happening with our public health infrastructure. Those are all choices we made decades ago, kind of disinvestment in public infrastructure. So the transformation scenario to us is moving to a very different kind of understanding of what is the cause of this. And it's moving kind of beyond what is called sort of neoliberalism. It's really understanding that we're actually all connected and that when we raise one boat, we raise all the boats. So we call it sort of social solidarity or mutualism scenario. And it involves lots of different policy choices, different kinds of choices. It involves investment of public resources in infrastructure, including public health infrastructure, education infrastructure, roads, and all kinds of things that basically give these very valuable resources and give access to them to more and more people. So it's leading to greater equity as well as hopefully some growth.
I'm talking right now to Marina Gorbis. She's executive director of the Institute for the Future. And if you have questions or if you have comments about how you think this current generation will be changed in the future, if you have children, what do you anticipate this event might mean for their lives? Please give us a call, 866-893-5722. Again, that's 866-893-5722. Or you can comment on the AirTalk page. One thing that I noticed, Marina, as I was reading and kind of getting ready for this conversation, is somebody pointed out that even though an event happens in history, say, you know, this pandemic is happening, depending on the age of the person that it happens to, it might affect them differently as they grow older. And that's along with certain factors like education gaps and stuff like that, which we might actually see as a result of this pandemic. You know, kids just aren't getting the same education access that they were getting before. Just about a minute before we have to go to break, and then we're going to come back to this and dive even deeper. But I'm sure a lot of people are wondering right now, are the kids going to be okay?
I think the kids will be okay. I do think that this event, to me, these kind of transformational events are the kind of events where people start seeing the world in a different way. And I think what we're seeing now is not just kids, but all of us, we're having a different image of the U.S. and our country. And I would say, in summary, it's we've been diminished. We have a diminished view of this country, and we have a diminished view of our own prospects and possibilities, which, by the way, is not a bad thing.
You are listening to AirTalk. I'm speaking with Marina Gorbis. She's executive director of the Institute for the Future, and we're discussing what the generational impact of COVID-19 and what this pandemic might be. We want to hear from you. How do you expect that you will look back on this time? How do you think the pandemic will shape your future, the future of your children? We would love to hear your thoughts on that. 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can tweet us at AirTalk. You can also comment on our Facebook page. When we come back from our break, just a couple minutes from now, we're going to bring in another guest for this conversation. It's Jane Hong, an associate professor of history at Occidental College. History is one of my favorite topics, and I truly believe that history gives us an idea of what we might expect in the future. We're going to hear her thoughts in just a minute. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle on Air Talk. This is Air Talk. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle, who is taking a much needed break. We were talking about how the pandemic could shape the lives of future generations here in America, and we want to hear from you. What do you think? How do you think the pandemic will shape your future, or maybe even the future of your kids? We're at 866-893-5722 again, 866-893-5722. I would love to hear your thoughts. You can also tweet us at AirTalk or leave a comment on our Facebook page. I want to bring in another guest for this conversation. It's Jane Hong, and she's an associate professor of history at Occidental College. Professor Hong, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Austin. It's great to be here.
Well, Professor, we have seen a lot of people compare the COVID-19 pandemic to the 1918 Spanish flu. I've seen it come up a lot. And of course, that is another 100-year disease event. But are there other parallels that we see between these two periods?
Well, I think that's a great question. And it might be helpful just to get a sense of what the 1918 flu pandemic looked like.
Sure.
So the 1918 pandemic, it lasted about 2 years, and it killed about 675,000 Americans out of a global total of 50 to 100 million. So much bigger in scale. It killed many healthy young people. So interestingly, many U.S. soldiers fighting in World War One, which was raging at the time. More U.S. soldiers actually died from the 1918 flu than actually were killed in battle during the war.
Wow.
And the flu spread, it spread everywhere. It affected people of all racial backgrounds, economic backgrounds. The U.S. president at the time, Woodrow Wilson, also reportedly contracted it. So that's, I guess, one historical parallel that we can point out. The COVID-19 pandemic, I mean, we're nearly a year in. It's killed about 350,000 Americans out of a global total of about 1.7 million deaths. we've seen that it disproportionately kills the elderly, the immunocompromised. Although young people have also had, serious long-term health deficiencies and also have died as a result. And we've also seen that COVID-19, due to a long history of racialized health and economic disparities, we've seen that it disproportionately killed Black and brown people at a rate of 3-1. So there are some similarities, but there are also lots of differences. In terms of, parallels, one thing that hasn't really changed in the United States, unfortunately, is in many ways the decentralized response that we've seen to managing the virus. So in 1918 to 1920, Americans in different cities, different places were ordered to wear masks, schools, theaters, businesses were shuttered. The New York City subway, for example, had restrictions. But in ways that are really eerily similar to now, these efforts were highly decentralized. They varied dramatically from place to place, in ways that hampered containment efforts and, arguably led to unnecessary deaths. And I think that you see similar kinds of parallels today. There were also, there were anti-maskers in 1918. I've seen a number of news articles about this. There's examples like the Anti-Mask League of San Francisco, but there were far fewer of these. Since wearing a mask in 1918 actually became, for many, an act of wartime patriotism, so a way to support the Allies fighting in World War I. And the final thing I'll say is one thing that's very different about the two pandemics that I think is really important for us to remember is the medical science. And on this front, rather than comparing the two pandemics, it's probably more accurate to see the 1918 flu pandemic as helping create the national and international infrastructures that have made it possible for the U.S. and other countries to develop vaccines today in such a short time. In 1918, there were no reliable diagnostic tests, no vaccines, no antiviral drugs. Many medical professionals they weren't very familiar with the idea of a virus, and many Americans didn't have reliable access to health care. So there was no centralized federal U.S. agency like the CDC of Anthony Fauci fame. And, it's actually in large part because of the 1918 flu pandemic that nations like the U.S. took steps to consolidate and expand healthcare. And also the 1918 flu pandemic led to the first international organizations designed to fight epidemics, like the WHO, for example. In many ways, the speed, the effectiveness of our scientists and medical professionals today, we owe a debt to the lessons that we learned in 1918.
I'm talking right now with Jane Hong, an associate professor of history at Occidental College. And that actually encourages me a little bit, Professor Hong. And I'll tell you why, because as a history person, I love to see how we got here, how we learn from our past mistakes, and we made things better in the future, and especially saved lives in the future. But I also have this sort of dread, if you spend any amount of time on Twitter, that there's a large portion of the country that has extremely misguided beliefs still about not only this virus and this pandemic, but and how we got here and how it spread and the importance of containing it. And I'm wondering, how confident are you in the future that history will record this moment accurately enough that we'll learn from the mistakes that we made today?
That is the question I think that many historians have been asking ourselves. We do this work. We meticulously study and research the past. And I think for myself and for many historians that I know, the hope really is that, the work that we do in writing about racial disparities, mistakes that we've made, state failures, right, would encourage people to think differently in the future. I think in terms of the medical science, we owe such a great debt to scientists, frontline medical professionals who are still working so hard, even though they are being attacked on Twitter. There are state officials, as all of us, or many of us know, if you've been following the news, health officials who are trying to protect the public are getting death threats, are getting harassed, kind of picketers and protesters on their lawns. So I think the scientific community, to their great credit, has been kind of steadily marching on. They've been doing their work. They've been learning from the past. They have been building on the science, the scientific expertise and knowledge that has accumulated over these past many years. In terms of, the misinformation, the disinformation, the Twitter wars, the anti-maskers, I mean, I have a daughter, and so I have to have some hope that, you know, whether it be just people who have some kind of influence or power would draw lessons from the past and would try not to repeat the mistakes of the present in future pandemics. I mean, the thing that I find really interesting is in reading about historians writing about the 1918 pandemic, several of them have noted that people seem to forget about it pretty soon after it happened. So the argument is it got lost in the crush of World War I's aftermath and the Great Depression. I mean, I don't really see that happening with this pandemic in the same way. I could be wrong, but I don't think people will really easily or soon forget their year of being inside in quarantine and you know, the mask debates. And so I do have great hope that, you know, in terms of, even if it's not individual Americans necessarily, that state officials, state agencies will learn lessons from this pandemic and will take steps to ensure that in the future there's better diagnostic testing, that there is contact tracing, that there are things the state can do to suppress misinformation about public health issues. And so I do have hope for that. I'm a historian, so I study the past. But again, the hope really is, as you mentioned earlier, the hope is that studying the past will help us to improve or to kind of not make the same mistakes in the future.
I think that your hope gives me hope. Thank you so much for that very thought-out answer. We also were speaking to this segment with Marina Gorbis, Executive Director of the Institute for the Future. And I know I could talk about this forever, but sadly, we must break. But I want to thank both of you for coming on, Marina Gorbis, as well as Professor Hong at Occidental. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle. Air Talk continues next hour. Stay with us. Happy Wednesday. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Austin Cross, filling in for Larry today as he takes a much needed and deserved break. A little bit later this hour, we will be talking about holiday drink ideas to close out this uniquely difficult year and to hopefully give you some new things to try out as we all try to enjoy our winter season. But before that, we would actually like to lighten up the mood by talking about some of the bright spots that came from this year. And we're doing it with community engagement editor for the Long Beach Post, Stephanie Rivera. Now, if you have any bright spots about this year that you would like to share with us, we're taking your calls, 866-893-5722. Again, 866-893-5722. At a time when good news seems to be so far and few, now's your opportunity. If you had a moment this year where you said, you know, everything else around me seems to be a dumpster fire, but this one good thing is happening to me right now. And I know, just even from personal experience, when good things happen, especially when so many other people are hurting right now, like in our community, it can be a bit of a challenge because you want to share the good news. You want to celebrate it. You want to celebrate it with the people around you. And yet you also feel maybe a little bit guilty that other people may be struggling while you're maybe experiencing one of the highs of your life. But now's the time because I think that shared happiness is the best kind of happiness. And we would like to be here to share your happiness. We'd like to hear what's making you smile, what has made your life good this year. So give us a call, 866-893-5722. You can also tweet us at AirTalk or leave a comment on the Facebook page. Just for context, some of our producers have already weighed in. Our producer, Natalie, says her bright spot is that her partner moved back to LA. They were doing distance and now they're quarantining together. It's like, it's night and day there, right? It's like they weren't together and now they're together all the time. It's a great thing. I want to hear what's good happening in your life. Again, 866-893-5722. Stephanie Rivera with the Long Beach Post. Thanks for making the time.
Hi, thanks for being here.
Well, one bright spot, surprising as it may be, actually came in politics, Stephanie, and more specifically, it was about representation in this year's elections. In this case, where you are, Long Beach, They made history by having the first Cambodian-American elected official in the city's history after Suli Saro defeated incumbent city councilman Dee Andrews, who represented the city's 6th district. And it's worth noting also that Long Beach has a pretty significant Cambodian population. They have Cambodia Town, which has the highest concentration of Cambodians outside of the country itself. So I'm wondering, having covered this community yourself, what was the reaction following Saro's electoral win?
Yeah, it was pretty huge. I'd say this is a long time coming for the community, something that they've been waiting about 45 years now. And really just something that I think was badly needed, that they felt just not having that kind of elected voice in the council and just in the community to really advocate for their needs. So I would say that it was definitely very historic moment, and just a lot of folks very much proud for one of their own to make it on the council.
That sounds so great. Well, if you would like to share some of your favorite moments of 2020, ones that lightened up your mood or your community at large, we'd like to hear them here on Air Talk. 866-893-5722. Again, that's 866-893-5722. Producer Manny says, my bright side is that the Lakers and the Dodgers won the championships. I'm sure that's a bright side for a lot of people. He loved seeing people celebrate. And, you know, he's only okay this time. And the only okay, this is the funniest part. And the only time I'm okay with fireworks, I want to hear the backstory on Manny's okayness with fireworks at some point. But Stephanie, you know, this year, as we know, it left a lot of people hurting financially and health-wise. And it may have created a lot of negative moments for us, but it also led to a lot of communities supporting one another during what's turned out to be a really desperate time. So, Stephanie, you covered a story like this about a woman named Martha Cota, who actually was able to get her fellow community members to help her out monetarily after her husband got COVID-19. Tell us about how that started and how people ended up assisting.
Yeah, well, I think Martha's definitely been a big member of the community for a long time now. And folks have recognized her work and, you know, with as an advocate for the immigrant population, for a lot of Latinos, parents, especially within the Long Beach Unified School District. So I think her being this long-term advocate for so many different types of issues, she really made a connection with so many different types of people as well. So when the time came, and even with her own work, she's a very humble woman. So she was not even letting folks know that her husband had been in the hospital for this time, intubated and just, you know, battling COVID. So once her group of, her friends, her really strong connections there, they got the word out. And just, you know, as soon as they put up the GoFundMe, you know, everyone was just starting to donate, to really spread the word, because, you know, for everyone, it was just remembering all those times that she's been there for them and to help the community. So it was really nice to see just the community getting together and coming together for an advocate that had been there for them.
We're talking right now with Stephanie Rivera, community engagement editor for the Long Beach Post. And Sherry joins us from Long Beach. Sherry, what's your happy moment of 2020?
Hi, thank you. You know, I didn't see this coming. I was really nervous in the beginning of all this lockdown. And my bright spot is my son's been living in Mexico City for the last 8 years. And then a year ago, he moved to Switzerland to get his master's degree at the School of Art there. And I just got really nervous, like, he's too far away. What if he gets sick? And so we started talking by phone, and we have like hour and a half long conversations like we never have before. And it's really been my amazing bright spot, getting to know my son in a different way after long chats. And I look forward to that. And we talk a couple times a week, and it's really beautiful. And he's doing fine.
Sherry, I'm really wondering if it's something that you can share with us, but what's one thing that stands out to you that you learned maybe about your son just through all of those extra conversations?
That he is, he's a man. The way that he speaks and the things that we talk about are things that you would talk about with an older person, I guess you could say. And I don't mean to say that he wasn't ever a man. I'm just like, I never have these really, really long conversations with him. And so he's very protective of me, and he's, you know, talking about things that I just didn't expect, you know, and he's been wonderful. It's been wonderful getting to know him from a different perspective. And that's it. you know, I really felt for him because he had gone so far and was accepted into this, you know, worldwide, you know, famous school. And then he's stuck inside this apartment. But he weathers the storm so well, and he always has. So I'm really proud of him. And yeah, but I miss him, of course.
Sherry, you sound like a real proud mother, and that is so great. And your joy is all of our joy. So I'm so glad that you got to know your son a lot better this year. Something good came out of such a dark time. David joins us, believe it or not, from Bar Harbor, Maine. David, what is your story?
Hello. My most recent event is I was COVID positive on a routine screening test, and luckily my family and my coworkers did not get infected from my illness or infection, and that made me grateful, incredibly grateful, that they're all fine. And the other thing is one of my best friends has renal carcinoma, and she is still with us. I didn't expect her to be, and I'm incredibly happy she's able to have Christmas and New Year's with her family. And the third thing would be my youngest son wanted a large, cuddly dog, and I contacted New England Newfoundland Rescue, and we ended up with our Newfoundland Max, who we got last April, and he's been a joyful addition to our house.
Isn't it amazing when the fur babies come into our lives? They just really change our lives a lot, don't they, David?
For a couple of years, and he's kids grew up with dogs, and it's great to have one again.
So. How's your family doing now, David? Is everybody okay and healthy?
Oh yeah, they're the three kids and my 91-year-old mom are all doing well. Luckily, I was able to sequester, hide myself away and quarantine myself away. That's the word. So, yeah.
That's so great, and I'm glad that you're on the mend right now. That's David actually joining us from Bar Harbor, Maine. Well, we want to hear more positive moments. I mean, this is giving me all the feels right now, and I am loving it. And I'm hoping that if you're listening in at home in your car, it's also becoming a bright spot in your week just to end out this year. Please give us a call, share your moments. We will be back in just a few. It's 866-893-5722. Again, 866-893-5722. A few people have tweeted us at AirTalk. I'm going to tell you about those in just a minute. You can also comment on our Facebook page. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle. I'm back in a few. Welcome back to AirTalk. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle, who is out this week. You know, last segment, we heard some really, really heartwarming stories about people's bright spots in 2020. And even though we've got to move on from that, we actually had a few people write in. I want to highlight those. The Mamalorian, I love that name, by the way. The Mamalorian tweets at AirTalk, this year she had a baby in May, the Dodgers won in October, and she started a new job with a promotion in December. The Mamalorian, everything is coming up Mamalorian right now. And by the way, we also have another one here, Susan from Venice. She says she's grateful to have gotten closer to her goddaughter's daughter, who resides in Seattle. She's 9 years old, and she's her fairy godmother. And she says, I usually don't get to see her, but this year they called me to do a fairy godmother camp through Zoom, and it really created a stronger bond between us. I just love hearing about how stronger bonds have been created, because 2020 is going to end. And the pandemic is going to end, but those beautiful bonds that people have formed will hopefully last a lifetime, and it will be really the bright spot that comes out of all of this. Well, coming up, we're going to wrap up this final show of the year with a drink or two or more, however many you might need to move past 2020 and into the new year. We're going to talk with experts about DIY cocktails. But first, we are not quite out of the woods with 2020 yet, the year that has brought many things, including an abundance of, get this, ready for this, new words to our everyday lives. I'm sure you're thinking of a few right now, aren't you? Well, here to talk about the most used words of 2020 and how the year has changed our language is LA Times science and features writer Deborah Netburn. Deborah, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, Deborah, let's kick off with some of the new words that we've seen floating in our conversations this year. And I have an idea of what the theme might be, but you tell us, what were some of the most commonly used ones?
Well, I just want to begin by saying that a lot of the words that were new to us this year are not actually new words.
Sure.
So there's really just really one major one that's brand new this year, which is COVID-19.
Oh, yeah.
But coronavirus, which has been around since the 70s, is a word I think a lot of us didn't know and are now very well acquainted with. I saw this interesting statistic that there was a point in time, maybe in March, when coronavirus was being used more than the word time in publications. And time is one of the words that we use the most. So I thought that was really interesting.
I mean, that's really incredible to me. But I mean, coronavirus has in some way been how we've marked time at this point. I think that what's funny is in future generations, they might look back on 2020 and say, oh, yeah, that was the pandemic year. But right now we look at 2020 and we think about all the different chapters of 2020 that we've seen, because we saw the early days in March when CNN started putting that little ticker up on their screen counting how many people had gotten the virus in the U.S. And then we saw things slowly progress. And I'd hate to say it, but, you know, we're in that really, really, really rough chapter of the pandemic right now. And I think that nuance usually gets lost over time. But I think that since we've lived it and it's so close at hand for us, we can look at these different moments of this year. And, you know, it's been really fascinating. But I'm really curious now. So what are some of the other more commonly used words that we've seen now that have maybe been out for a long time but are kind of rising in usage?
Yeah, well, I think you know, this is the year that we all kind of became budding epidemiologists and are all kind of making decisions, right, all the time about what feels safe, what feels smart. So words like flatten the curve or quarantine or contact tracing are words that we probably really didn't use before and are using a lot more now. And I also just wanted to say, because we were talking about the different chapters, one of the things that was really interesting in my reporting was that in the beginning of the year, the word bushfire had really risen to the top. And it's like hard to even remember at this point, but that was when those giant fires in Australia were burning, you know? So like, it's just so interesting how the words that we use really represent like what we're all talking about and thinking about at a certain time. It's like a really interesting timeline of the past.
You know, we'd love to hear from our listeners. What's the word that you think has gained the most prominence in 2020? Or maybe there's one that you've started using in your everyday language. Give us a call right now. We'd love to hear it. 866-893-5722. Again, that's 866-893-5722. I mean, another thing that's really interesting to me, Deborah, is that over the years, words kind of rise and fall. And this is something that you looked at, because back in the year 2000, the word of the year was Chad. And right. I think people of a certain age might know why, but why was Chad the word in 2000?
Right, because of those hanging Chads in Florida.
Oh, yes.
That were kind of like determining, you know, or it seemed like the election was resting on them. And I just... I mean, I'll be honest, like I have not thought about language in this way before I started reporting this story, but it's just, it really is an amazing kind of historical look at, what people are talking about, you know, at a given time. I also wanted to say, another word that I think a lot of us use very differently than we did before is Zoom.
Yes.
If you think about what Zoom used to mean to us, it was like a lens or a shot, you know what I mean? Like a, in a film. And now, I mean, you know, Zoom call, Zoom cocktails, Zoom bombing, right? So that's been a big shift too.
We would love to hear from our listeners. What word has gained prominence in 2020? Give us a call, 866-893-5722. Again, that's 866-893-5722. Or you can comment on our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. You know, Deborah, something that I thought of as I was starting to prepare for this conversation is are there words that you think, just as words rise, like coronavirus, words that maybe might be pushed down to the bottom of the heap rather quickly, like the words germaphobe? Because I know when I've been working in radio now for 12 years at this point, and something that I've always been, as people have described it, is a bit of a germaphobe, because when you get sick, usually the first thing that goes is your voice, right? But I wonder if in this year, you just call it being careful, you just call it being smart. Do you think that there are going to be words that might get pushed farther down in our lexicon over the coming years?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that the lexicographers and linguists that I talked to said is that they don't actually expect most of the words that we're using right now to last, you know, that, I mean, they'll, you know, they'll, or go back to the domains that they're used to being in, which is like infectious disease researchers, right? Because, you know, they described vocabulary as fashion, and kind of like things, words come into fashion and words go out of fashion. And so, and you know, we really use our words to describe our reality, and our reality right now is so defined by this pandemic and this virus. But when that, you know, God willing, that will no longer be the case in some amount of time. And then, you know, those are words that we may not be using anymore. But they do think that sort of like 9/11 means something to us still, you know, many years later, that COVID, you know, COVID will probably mean something to us in perpetuity, you know, that that is a word that's gonna remain for a really long time and define this moment in time.
Some words certainly seem to sear themselves into our memories for our lifetimes. I think 9/11 is certainly one of them. Elizabeth in Los Feliz says the word before times is a phrase that she has started to use often. Ooh, it's such a morbid sounding word to me. In the before times. Meanwhile, Bill in Calabasas says there's a couple of words that he started using this year that he really hadn't used in the past, and those words are comorbidity and vector, as in viral vector. Meanwhile, Mary in Glendora says the word mask, and she's never really used it except for Halloween. Patricia is on the line right now. She's in Carthay Circle. Patricia, what are the words that you've started to use more this year?
Two really obvious ones here, Zoom and pandemic itself.
You know, Patricia, I'm really curious because before this year, I think I'd been among the lucky people who had maybe never had to sit in on a Zoom meeting before. We use conference lines, but Zoom was a brand new concept to me at the beginning of this year. Did you ever utilize Zoom before 2020?
You know, I hadn't. I'm a community college professor, so I had to very, very quickly change it up and go from in-person, in-person to doing them Zoom. And it was challenging, but I learned pretty quickly because it's trial by fire.
There's a whole different skill set. One thing that I've actually noticed is watching people use Zoom, and my wife, she's a high school teacher, so she's a real native at it at this point, where she can create the breakout rooms and do all sorts of neat things. And I think I'm still on the 1.0 level of Zoom understanding right now. But Deborah, you know, final thought from you here with just about 10 seconds left. Is there one word that you think that you've used more this year than in any years past that, you know, has really, you know, you've maybe stayed up late at night and thought, oh, wow, I use this word a lot?
Well, it was really only when I, you know, started doing this story. But one word that I use a lot is 2020, just to sum up this moment, you know, like, or and really, I think of it as a pile on, like, oh, that's so 2020, or, you know, well, because 2020, you know, so I that's a word that I've found myself.
That is so real. Deborah Netburn, LA Times science and features writer, thank you so much for being with us. More Air Talk ahead. Stay with us. It's Air Talk. I'm Austin Cross, filling in for Larry Mantle. Some sad news to start this segment. The Hollywood Reporter reporting that Dawn Wells, you know, Marianne from Gilligan's Island, she's died in Los Angeles at the age of 82. So sad. She was one of my favorites. Well, I don't know how you were planning on celebrating the new year, but I think it's official at this point. It's officially safe to say that we need a drink after simply living through 2020. Well, we have some cocktail connoisseurs with us here today to answer your questions and to also give us some good ideas on how we might drown some of our sorrows. Joining us is Frances Cannon, Executive Director of the LA County Brewers Guild. She's also the Associate Editor for the Craft Beer News site and podcast The Full Pint. I love that name. Frances, so good to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me today, Austin.
Well, Frances, I want to start off just by asking your personal plans for the New Year's. What kind of drinks are you planning to make to send off this year and put it into the history books?
Oh, my goodness. Well, there are just so many choices. You know, I hope that along with everybody else listening today, we're all having low-key within our household New Year's Eve plans. I know that champagne is the New Year's Eve drink of choice for many, but coming from the craft beer world, I have to tip my hat to different local breweries from all over Los Angeles County. You know, you could always have fun with that, with making beer cocktails, which are, you know, fun alternatives. But I often get the question during the holiday season from people who claim that they don't like the, quote, taste of beer, what kind of beers I would recommend for them during the holiday season. And I would say that, you know, beer taste, quotes, is usually the, you know, light and watery or cheap and oxidized swill that you may have encountered in your college years. And, you know, not knocking that if that's your personal taste, but, you know, craft breweries in Los Angeles and all across the world rose in prominence because of their obsession with full flavors. So be it a hoppy IPA or, you know, a robust porter or stout, there's really, you know, something across the entire spectrum of flavors for you to dive into. For me, I'm definitely going to be reaching for a dry Saison as a champagne alternative. This is also great for those who want to avoid these notorious champagne hangovers as well.
You know, Frances Cannon, I think the drink of choice in general is just drink, if I think about it for this year. And you're so right, because during my college experience, you know, beer at the beginning, before we saw the light, Frances, it wasn't so great. I didn't really understand what it was about it that kept bringing people back. But then craft beers, we're really in a golden age of that right now, and I'm simply loving it. I mean, my producer wants to know this, though, and I want to know, too, but what's a beer cocktail, and is there a really simple one that you can just give us back-of-the-envelope recipe right now?
I think, you know, well, being from L.A., I'm an L.A. native, micheladas, you know, it's that nice, spicy, tomatoey, it's kind of like the beer Bloody Mary type of thing. But I think the easiest for New Year's brunch would be just a simple beer mosa, you know, orange juice and substituting the champagne with, you know, either a nice lager or a Hefeweizen even, which is already a citrus forward style. That would be just an easy peasy beer cocktail to start off with. But I personally like a stout hot chocolate, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's a hot chocolate with topped with a little float of a stout beer, which is nice, rich, and chocolatey.
You know, yesterday we were speaking with Jot Condi with the California Restaurant Association, and he did mention that many microbrewers here have been struggling as a result of the shutdown. So really quickly, before I go to Dominic Smith, who's a bartender over at Geneva, quick shout-out time. Are there any places in L.A. that we L.A. natives, you and me and other people who are maybe new here, who can enjoy?
I'm just going to shamelessly plug our own website, which actually has a listing of all 95 independently owned craft breweries in Los Angeles County. So be sure to head to labrewersguild.org or follow us at LA Brewers to find the closest craft brewery to you.
Oh, I'm excited for that. Well, also with us, as I mentioned, is Dominic Smith, bartender of the LA-based gin joint, Geneva. Good to have you with us today, Dominic.
Likewise, Austin. Thank you for having me.
Well, Dominic, I think I have an idea of what the main ingredient might be in your drinks, but what kind of drinks did you prepare during this past holiday season?
So I do tend to focus on gin through the Geneva, which is a ton of fun, and gin is a wonderfully complex spirit that, similarly to sort of college-age beer, a lot of people are turned away from the idea of gin. based on some past unpleasant experiences, but it is a wonderful, complex, and super diverse spirit that can really go well with pretty much anything based on the brand that you choose.
You know, Dominic, with all the mess that's happened this year, what I actually really want to know right now is if you have a cocktail for 2020, and, you know, what would you call it if there was a cocktail for 2020?
I do, actually. This is not one of my own, but for the real dumpster fire that has been 2020, I think none of us could go wrong with a classic adios to sort of send the year off with a final kick in the pants. That is a riff on a Long Island iced tea. It is a half ounce each of vodka, rum, tequila, gin, blue curacao, 2 ounces of sour mix, and topped with Sprite. So
I think there is a part of the describing of that drink, Dominic, that was not radio appropriate or friendly, but that drink that takes us back in time. I'm sure a lot of us have had that experience. You know, Francis, just to go back to you really quickly, you know, with every good cocktail or drink, there's also a good food pairing to go along with it. And I'm sure some of us even have a nice glass of wine when we're cooking a meal. So I'm wondering if you can tell us what kind of holiday food drink pairs do you recommend for the holiday?
I particularly like eating cheese during the holiday season. It's my excuse to make elaborate cheese boards for my household of two people. So I would say that I love having, you know, a rich and roasty porter with, you know, some brie, you know, just some or some blue cheese and an IPA, just like, you know, really playing off of some of these flavors. And I think, you know, now's the time to experiment, right? When you're not really hosting large groups of people, you can, you know, head to your local cheesemonger, ask for the small slivers and experiment with flavors like that. But you can't really go wrong with chocolate on chocolate as well. So, you know, I'll take a chocolate stout and, you know, a slice of pie or a piece of cake any day.
Well, Dominic, really quickly with the time that we have left, for those kind of beginner bartenders out there as we're looking ahead, what kind of universal drink essentials do you think should be in our cupboards just so that we're ready for anything that might happen?
Absolutely. I mean, aside from a solid base of your classic spirits, rum, vodka, gin, tequila, etc., I think that you really can't go wrong with a bottle of Angostura bitters. That is one of my personal favorites and adds a lot of complexity to pretty much any cocktail. And then a couple bottles of Amaro or like a red bitter, like a Campari or an Aperol, something like that, that can kind of give you a fancy flair at home and make you feel like a mixologist or a bartender within your own house.
Those are all great recommendations. My guests for this past segment, they've been Dominic Smith, bartender of L.A.-based gin joint Geneva, and Francis Cannon of the L.A. County Brewers Guild. You know, we've had quite the year here on KPCC, but I'd just like to take this time at the end of our show, the last show for Air Talk of 2020, just to thank you for sticking with us, because there's been so much news. I mean, some of it has been positive, but a lot of it maybe hasn't made us feel great about the way that things are headed. But it just means so much to us that you stay with us here. And we were talking a little bit earlier about people's high points of the year. And I'll say about 6 years ago, I was sitting on the other side of the glass producing Air Talk, and look at life now. You know, you never know what's going to happen, and if we keep pushing forward, I'm sure great things are going to be ahead for you and for the people that you love in 2021. So thank you again for listening to KPCC. Thank you for choosing us every day. And Larry Mantle will be back next week with more Air Talk. I'm Austin Cross. Take care.